want to get back into the evolution study. So last time I said we were going to cover the creation aspect first and cover the truth, and then we'll refute the error, and that's what I want to get into today. And I want to talk about what I've called the folly of the fairy tale of evolution. And I think any evolution, and I probably mentioned, I know I've said this before, but any evolutionary textbook should start out with once upon a time in a land far away, you know, this little amoeba, blah, 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 whatever. So it really is a fairy tale. It's just something constructed in their minds. And I even have a quote from Stephen Jay Gould that almost basically says that they just kind of inferred a lot of this stuff and constructed it up in the textbooks. It's rather humorous. So today the theory of evolution is taught as if it were a scientific fact. I mean, you would think it was the law of gravity that they're talking about. I've even had evolutionists tell me that. The debate is over. It's been over. Evolution is a fact. And they're talking about macroevolution, molecules to man. It's a fact, and as if it's the law. And then you point out the fact that it's a theory, and then, you know, they don't like that. Apparently a scientific theory is the same as a scientific fact, according to them. That's what they say anyway. But it's important to distinguish the difference between microevolution and macroevolution. And once again, they'll say, well, there is no difference. They're the same thing. But they're not the same thing. The dictionary will tell you that, and common sense will tell you that. Now, I have some quotes on that, too. Microevolution is evolutionary change within a species. That's very important. Within a species or smaller group of plants or animals taking a relatively short time. So that happens all the time, microevolution. And that's what Darwin observed when he was on the Galapagos Islands with the finches. That's exactly what he saw, microevolution. Within a species, things change. That happens all the time. That's not macroevolution. It's not even close to the same thing. Macroevolution is evolutionary change over a long period of time, or over a long period, leading to the appearance of new groups of plants or animals. So that's very different of change, small change within a group, and change leading to a new group. One happens all the time, one never has happened, and probably never will happen. Now, like I said, microevolution happens all the time, and it's been observed and well documented. Natural selection happens all the time, but natural selection cannot produce new genes, and rather than facilitate macroevolution, it actually prevents it. When I first read this, I thought, that's really interesting, and the more I thought about it, and I have a nice lengthy quote here for you, and I think you'll see what I'm talking about. Natural selection, they say, is how macroevolution comes about, by nature selecting one animal that has characteristics that enable it to live, and then it continues to reproduce itself, and then eventually that mutation reproduced over and over again, that animal will eventually evolve into another type of animal that is more well-fitted for its environment. But the thing is, with natural selection, as I will show here, natural selection actually prevents macroevolution. It gets rid of genes, and I'll show you that. This is a quote from a guy named Dr. Walt Brown. He wrote a book called In the Beginning, and I'll be quoting from that extensively today. And I don't like quoting just from one source, although I do have quotes from, he has references in this book. It is extremely well documented. The nice thing about the book is I'd recommend it for anybody. It's almost written in outline form, where he breaks it up into different larger sections, but then within the sections, he'll just number the points, you know, from 1 to 100 and whatever. And then you can go through, and it's usually just a short paragraph on each point. And just that alone, you'd be like, well, that's a neat idea. Okay, fine, you know, but you haven't substantiated it. But he's got every little thing that he says documented. You go back to the middle of the book there and look in that section, and then he's got the full quote, you know, the scientific journal and everything. So it's great. I mean, everything is extremely documented, but you can read over it just briefly, and you don't have to get bogged down in scientific journals and everything, and you can get the basic point. It's a great book. Anyway, so this is a quote from that. He says, like so many terms in science, the popular meaning of natural selection differs from what the words actually mean. Selecting implies something that nature cannot do, thought, decision-making, and choice. Instead, the complex genetics of each species allow variations within a species. In changing environments, those variations give some members of the species a slightly better chance to reproduce than other members, so their offspring have a better chance of surviving. The marvel is not about some capability that nature does not have, but about the designer who designed the adaptability and survivability in changing environments. With that understanding, the unfortunate term natural selection will be used. You think about it. God is the one that designed all those genes that can be turned on and off and that can adapt to environment. They're all in there. They're just not all used all the time because you're not always starving or you're not always in a hotter environment than you are or something. But within us are all kinds of genes that can be flipped on and off based on our environment to allow us to survive in different things. So that's the amazing part of it. Anyway, that was my words. He continues, an offspring of a plant or animal has characteristics that vary, often in stable or in subtle ways, from those of its, quote, parents. Because of the environment, genetics, and chance circumstances, some of these offspring will reproduce more than others. So members of a species with certain characteristics will tend, on average, to have more children. Only in this sense does nature select genetic characteristics suited to an environment, and more importantly, eliminates unsuitable genetic variations. Therefore, an organism's gene pool is constantly decreasing. Natural selection gets rid of species with characteristics. It doesn't add different characteristics. Notice natural selection cannot produce new genes. It selects only among pre-existing characteristics. As the word selection implies, variations are reduced, not increased. For example, many mistakenly believe that insect or bacteria resistances evolved in response to pesticides and antibiotics. And that's a common argument. If you've ever talked to evolutionists, that's probably one argument that will almost always come up. Why do you take antibiotics for the whole length of time you're supposed to? So it completely kills off, you know, everything. But then there are bacteria that build up resistances to those antibiotics, so they say, and then those bacteria will evolve and become stronger and stronger. But that's actually not what happens. I mean, it's half true, but it's not totally true. Here's what he says. Instead, and there's a few possibilities of what happened whenever bacteria develop resistances to antibiotics. A lost capability was reestablished, making it appear that something evolved, or a mutation reduced the ability of certain pesticides or antibiotics to bind to an organism's proteins, or a mutation reduced the regulatory function or transport capacity of certain proteins, or a damaging bacteria mutation or variation reduced the antibiotic's effectiveness even more, or a few resistant, and this is the one that probably happens a lot, a few resistant insects or bacteria were already present when the pesticides and antibiotics were first applied. When the vulnerable insects and bacteria were killed, resistant varieties had less competition and therefore proliferated. And that's what happens. And they have found bacteria. They found old bacteria from like in the 1800s, cultured it, kind of, you know, revived it, and then found that this bacteria was resistant to modern antibiotics. Well, how'd that happen? It didn't happen because it evolved because of modern antibiotics. Those bacteria have been dormant for 150 years. So anyway, yeah, there were bacteria that just happened to have those genes which were resistant to that. When it kills everything else off, all that's left is that bacteria, and it's all on its own, and it can reproduce because there's not as much competition. He continues, while natural selection occurred, nothing evolved. In fact, some biological diversity was lost. The variations Darwin observed among finches and on different Galapagos Islands is another example of natural selection producing micro, not macro, evolution. Now, this is important. While natural selection sometimes explains the survival of the fittest, it does not explain the origin of the fittest. Let me read that again. While natural selection sometimes explains the survival of the fittest, it does not explain the origin of the fittest. Today, some people think that because natural selection occurs, evolution must be correct. Actually, natural selection prevents major evolutionary changes. It deletes information. It cannot create information. Now, mutations are what evolution is mainly based on, that there be mutations in an animal's genes, and those mutations will cause something different to come about in that animal and give it some upper hand, so the story goes. It'll give it an upper hand in its environment, and then it will live, and other ones that didn't have that beneficial mutation will die off. But that rarely, if ever, happens. Mutations are almost always bad, science has shown. they're not helpful to life, and they're almost always harmful. Here's another quote from Mr. Brown. He says, mutations are the only known means by which new genetic material becomes available for evolution. Rarely, if ever, is a mutation beneficial to an organism in its natural environment. Almost all observable mutations are harmful. Some are meaningless. Many are lethal. No known mutation has ever produced a form of life having greater complexity and viability than its ancestors. And you think about it, most mutations that you see a baby born with a mutation, he's probably not going to be any better off than his brothers and sisters if he's got a third arm or something like that, you know, or missing his legs. So most mutations are not good. They're almost always bad. Now, the problem with macroevolution is it's never happened. That's kind of a major problem for evolutionists. It's never happened. I would say macroevolution is kind of like Santa Claus. Everybody talks about him, but nobody's actually ever seen it. You know, everybody talks about it like it exists, you know, and they even tell their kids it exists, but, you know, they've never actually seen it. It's kind of like people signing up for Obamacare. Everyone assumed that it happens, but nobody's actually witnessed it. So anyway, I had to get my politics in there too. In order to be scientific, macroevolution would have to be observed. I'm speaking of the science, the laboratory science, not the other science that you were talking about. Let's look at the law of biogenesis. I'm sure you've heard of this before. This would contradict the idea of spontaneous generation of life. That spontaneous generation, meaning life that just kind of pops up out of nowhere on its own, that's never happened. It's never been observed anywhere, in any test tube, in any experiment. And they've tried. They tried years ago. They created some environment, and they put in all the building blocks that they thought were necessary for life, different amino acids or proteins or whatever, and then struck it with electricity and all this stuff. You know, for sure, this would produce life, and it produced nothing, absolutely nothing. Life only comes from life. I'll give you another quote from Dr. Brown. He says, spontaneous generation, which is the emergence of life from non-living matter, has never been observed. All observations have shown that life comes only from life. This has been observed so consistently, it is called the law of biogenesis. The theory of evolution conflicts with this scientific law when claiming that life came from non-living matter through natural processes. He continues, evolutionary scientists reluctantly accept the law of biogenesis. However, some say that future studies may show how life could come from lifeless matter despite virtually impossible odds. Others say that their theory of evolution doesn't begin until the first life somehow arose. Still others say the first life was created, then evolved, then evolution occurred. All evolutionists recognize that based on scientific observation, life comes only from life. So there are some Christian evolutionists that would say, well, yeah, God created the first single cell, and then it took off from there. I mean, what kind of a pitiful God do you worship if he's going to create this whole universe and then create a single cell on earth and then allow it to evolve over billions of years, and then it would take all the credit for his creation? I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous. But this is the one question that evolutionists, atheists, they cannot answer. Where did the first life come from? Even if you go down to the first single cell, where did it come from? It could not have spontaneously arose. It's impossible. Darwin, his idea of a cell literally was just a blob. He just thought it was just kind of like just a little something, you know, a little piece of jelly or something. He had no idea. And nothing against him. They just didn't have the technology back then, the microscopes and everything. He just didn't know. Knowing what, I wonder if he would come up with the same theory now, knowing what we know now. I don't know. Because the cell is incredibly complex. The cell is like a little factory, a little machine in there. I mean, it reproduces itself, it cleans itself, it does all kinds of stuff. Anybody that's taken any biology knows. The idea of a cell just spontaneously generating is absolutely ridiculous. It'd be like a factory just spontaneously generating because of, you know, a windstorm or something blew all these elements in there and it just happened. It doesn't happen. Let's look at acquired characteristics. Animals and humans do not pass on characteristics which they've acquired during their lives. So the fact that I have these huge muscles that I've acquired through all my non-workout would not be passed on to my children if I had children. They wouldn't have these big bulky biceps that I have if I had kids. They would have to work hard like I have to get them. And of course I'm being completely ridiculous and facetious. But that doesn't happen. You can't, if you work and study and get really, really smart, your kids are going to come out as dumb as rocks. They're not going to be as smart just because you worked hard and exercised your brain. It doesn't, you can't pass on those characteristics. Here's a quote from Walt Brown again. Acquired characteristics. Characteristics gained after birth cannot be inherited. For example, large muscles acquired by a man in a weightlifting program cannot be inherited by his child. Nor did giraffes get long necks because their ancestors stretched to reach high leaves. While, and that's what they say. I mean, it's stupid. While almost all evolutionists agree that acquired characteristics cannot be inherited, many unconsciously slip into this false belief. On occasion, Darwin did. However, stressful environments for some animals and plants cause their offspring to express various defenses. New genetic traits are not created. Instead, the environment can switch on genetic machinery already present. The marvel is that optimal genetic machinery already exists to handle some contingencies, not that time, the environment, or a need can produce the machinery. That's the marvel. It's all in there. God has designed it all in there so that genes can be flipped on and can help us to survive in harsh environments. That's the neat thing about it. It's a machine that has all this stuff programmed in there that's not normally used, but can be. It's all in there. I think it's fascinating. No animal has ever been observed evolving from one species to another, and that's what macroevolution is. But this has never been observed. Here's another quote from Walt Brown. Scientists have done experiments on animals that reproduce themselves frequently. So to do an experiment for macroevolution on humans that live 80 years, well, nobody's really going to be around long enough to observe many generations of humans, right? Because we all die off before they die. So they pick animals like fruit flies, which makes sense because a fruit fly only, his whole lifespan is a whopping 10 days. You know, he's born, he does whatever he does, and then he dies 10 days later. So, you know, he doesn't really have much of a chance at a prosperous life, but you know, that's how it goes. So Dr. Brown says, a century of fruit fly experiments involving 3,000 consecutive generations gives absolutely no basis for believing that any natural or artificial process can cause an increase in complexity and viability. 3,000 generations. You take 3,000 generations of people, that's a long time. And I don't know what it would be, 120,000 years or something like that. I mean, that's a significant amount of time, comparatively speaking. No clear genetic improvement has ever been observed in any form of life, despite the many unnatural effects to increase mutation rates. So they've taken these poor little fruit flies over 3,000 generations and subjected them to all kinds of stuff to try to see if they can get beneficial mutation. And you know what they have after 3,000 generations, after like 100 years of experimentation? A bunch of sick fruit flies. They got fruit flies. No new species of fruit flies. They didn't turn into birds or caterpillars or anything else. They have fruit flies. But we'll just keep looking. They'll find it. Don't worry. They assure me. I was debating with this evolutionist and getting on him about life spontaneously arising. And he admits that it never happened, but just give us time. We're really, really close. I said, I will be waiting with bated breath. Let's look at fully developed organs. You would think that if macroevolution is true and one species is continually evolving into another, you'd look at every organism out there and he would have partially developed organs that are kind of evolving over time. You know, you wouldn't have all these completely functioning organs. You'd have some that aren't complete. You know, maybe some that are kind of going away because they're not useful anymore or something. Here's another quote from Walt Brown. He says, all species appear fully developed, not partially developed. They show design. There are no examples of half-developed feathers, eyes, skin, tubes, which are arteries or veins or intestines, or any vital organs, dozens in humans alone. Tubes, like the arteries or veins or intestines, tubes that are not 100% complete are a liability. So are partially developed organs in some body parts. For example, and I thought this is an excellent example. For example, if a leg of a reptile were to evolve into a wing of a bird, which is what they tell us happened, it would become a bad leg long before it became a good wing. Makes sense, right? How is that poor little reptile, that his little leg is somehow turning into a wing for millions of years, how's he going to get around very well with that half wing flopping around there? I mean, just think about it. It's not rocket science. Unbelievable. If you really just think about what macroevolution says and just stop looking at the textbooks and all the pretty pictures, I don't know how anybody can believe this crap. It's unreal. Here's a quote from a guy named Charles Darwin. Anybody ever heard of him? Yeah, he wrote The Origin of Species, you know, the father of evolution pretty much. Old Charlie said, and I think this is awesome, he said, and this is in his book, Origin of Species. He probably wish he would have deleted this sentence, I would think. But he said, to suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for emitting different amounts of light, and the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. I completely agree, Mr. Darwin. It seems absurd because it is absurd. It's absolutely ridiculous. There's something, and I mean, this is 150 years ago, and he realized how complex the eye is. I would venture to guess we probably found out that it's even more complex than he realized back then through all of our technology. Yes, he freely confesses it seems absurd that the eye could have evolved with small increments over time. Completely agree. Here's another one from Charlie. Page 179 of Origin of Species. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find no such case. Well, just keep looking, buddy, because there's no organ that could be formed in such a way. He's absolutely right. His theory completely breaks down. He's right, because none of those organs, how are you going to have a heart that formed over millions of years? It either pumps blood or it doesn't. I mean, how's a heart going to form by evolution? That's just absolutely ridiculous. I can't imagine an educated, intelligent man even thinking that that could happen. God from the beginning created plants and animals to reproduce after their kind. So finally, let's get to the Bible for a little bit here, and then I got a bunch more stuff. I don't generally preach like this, you know that, and I don't particularly like it, but I think it's necessary once in a while. What I'm basically doing is taking nature's book and confirming what God's book says. Genesis 1, let's look at verses 11 and 12. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herb yielding seed and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. Verse 21. And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. Verse 24 and 25. And God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. Did you see a recurring statement there? After their kind, after his kind. The Bible realizes that animals only produce after their kind, after their own species. The Bible recognized that a long, long time ago. Evolutionists still don't understand it. They think that one species produces another species over time. But God says they only produce after their kind. Cows produce cows, not kittens, right? That's how it works. A kind is a class, group, or division of things, a race or a natural group of animals or plants having a common origin. Now, this is very similar to the word species. We use the word species today to mean kind. They're synonyms. A species is in kind, in respect of kind, specifically. Now, species in the plural, that's normally how we speak of We say species, not normally specie. In these zoology, and if you're speaking of zoology and botany, animals and plants, it's a group or class of animals or plants, usually constituting a subdivision of a genus. Is that genus or genus? I think it's genus. Having certain common or permanent characteristics which clearly distinguish it from other groups. So that's what we all know what a species is. That's the exact same thing as a kind, as the Bible would call it. It still holds true today that animals and plants can only reproduce after their kind or their species. That's still the way it is. Nothing's changed. Now, evolution teaches that one species produced all species. You think about that. They really teach that all life on earth, plant and animal, came from one single cell. One cell created all the trees, all the plants, all the animals, everything from one cell. That's ridiculous. If you believe that, I've got some good investments I'd like to sell you, because you're obviously very gullible. Do you know that gullible is not even a word, actually? Yeah. Look it up in the dictionary. Gullible is not actually a word. All right. Yeah, that's a good one. You guys are so gullible. There is no evidence of macroevolution in the fossil record. So not only is there no evidence of macroevolution that we see in life today in all the species, we don't see, you know, half apes and half men or anything like that. All we see are a bunch of distinct species. Well, it's the same in the fossil record. The best argument against evolution is the fossil record. The very thing that they tout is where they get all their stuff from is the best argument against it. Absolutely. I mean, it's the best argument for creation. It's the fossil record. Interesting. If macroevolution actually occurred, there would have to be millions of transitional forms in the fossil record, which is one species of animal evolving into another species by minute increments. That's what I mean by transitional forms. There'd have to be millions of them. This isn't just my idea. Listen to old Charlie Darwin in The Origin of Species. He says, but as by this theory, that's his theory, innumerable transitional forms. I say again, innumerable. That's a bunch, in case you didn't know. Innumerable transitional forms must have existed. Why do we not find them embedded in countless numbers in the crust of the earth? Good question. Maybe because there aren't any. Chuck, come on. Here's another one from Charlie. He says, same book, Origin of Species, but just in proportion as this process of extermination has acted on an enormous scale, so the extermination of species was happening on an enormous scale, he's saying, so must the number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed on Earth be truly enormous. Let me read that again. I'm going to take out the little comma clause. So must the number of intermediate varieties be truly enormous. Absolutely. There would have to be millions and millions of them. I mean, it would be like taking a cartoon. You ever make a cartoon on paper? You know, you take a little pad of paper, and you draw a picture, and then you slightly change the picture. You make his arm move. Then and you see him move. That's what the fossil record should look like. We should see increments, you know, just tiny little increments between species. And even if the fossil record, even if it was only periods of time where things got fossilized, you should still see increments of things changing, and you don't. You don't see that at all. He continues there. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. Absolutely. I don't know why you did. Why did you even finish the book after that sentence? Moron. I mean, come on. So, okay, maybe 150 years ago, they just hadn't found all the fossils in the fossil record yet. There was a whole bunch yet undiscovered. And in the last 150 years, we've found all the missing links, all the fossils in the fossil record that Darwin just couldn't understand why they hadn't found them yet. Maybe that's happened. Let's see. I got another quote for you. This one is from a man named David M. Raup. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. It's in a book called, or an article called, Conflicts Between Darwin and Paleontology. It's in the Field Museum of Natural History Bulletin, Volume 50. This is in 1979. He says, Well, we are now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. Oh, good, I want to find all these transitional forms. I'm sure they're going to be everywhere. We now have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. Darn. The record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky, and ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. Oh, we're going the wrong way. Shoot. By this I mean that some of the classic cases of Darwinian change in the fossil record, such as the evolution of the horse in North America, have had to be discarded or modified as a result of more detailed information. What appeared to be a nice simple progression when relatively few data were available now appears to be much more complex and much less gradualistic. So Darwin's problem has not been alleviated in the last 120 years, and we still have a record which does show change, but one that can hardly be looked upon as the most reasonable consequence of natural selection. Doesn't sound like the evolutionist, their theory is getting any better or more believable. Here's one from a man named S.M. Stanley. It's The New Evolutionary Timetable, Fossils, Genes, and the Origin of Species, 1981. He says, species that were once thought to have turned into others have been found to overlap in time with these alleged descendants. Well, that's a problem. In fact, the fossil record does not convincingly document a single transition from one species to another. Not even one, let alone innumerable, not even one. This is from David S. Woodruff, Evolution, the Paleontological View in Science Magazine, volume 208, May 1980. He says, but fossil species remain unchanged throughout the most of their history, and the record fails to contain a single example of a significant transition. A single example. This is in Science Magazine. This isn't on Ken Ham's website, you know, Answers in Genesis or something. Here's another one for you. This is from Oswald Spengler, The Decline of the West, Volume 2. He says, there is no more conclusive refutation of Darwinism than that furnished by paleontology. See, that's what I told you. Simple probability indicates that fossil hoards can only be best samples, be test samples. Each sample then should represent a different stage of evolution, and there ought to be merely transitional types, no definition, and no species. Exactly. Instead of this, we find perfectly stable and unaltered forms persevering through long ages, forms that have not developed themselves on the fittest principle, but appear suddenly and at once in their definitive shape. And the bolding is his, not mine. That do not thereafter evolve toward better adaptation, but become rarer and finally disappear, while quite different forms crop up again. What unfolds itself in ever-increasing richness and form is the great classes and kinds of living beings which exist aboriginally and exist still without transition types in the grouping of today. Here's a quote from Stephen Jay Gould, very famous evolutionary scientist. And when I was at the meetup the other day debating with the atheist, I brought this outline with me. And I said, I got a quote I want to read you. Have you ever heard of a guy named Stephen Jay Gould? And they're like, I acted like I didn't even know who he was. And they're like, of course I've heard of him. Everybody's heard of him that debates this kind of stuff, right? So I said, well, I got a quote for you from him. This is Gould in The Return of Hopeful Monsters. He said, all paleontologists know that the fossil record contains precious little in the way of intermediate forms. Transitions between major groups are characteristically abrupt. Precious little. This is out of their own mouth. This isn't the enemy saying that. This is them admitting it on their own. Here's another one from Mr. Gould. This is an Evolution's Erratic Pace in Natural History. It's a publication of some sort. Volume 86, 1987. He says, I love it, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. So there's no trunk or branches, just at the very tips. We just have all these defined species. The rest is inference. You see that? The rest is inference. However reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. He flat out admits it. It's all inference. All the pretty pictures in the textbook are inference. In other words, they're lies they made up. That's what he means by inference. We fancy ourselves as the only true students of life's history. Well, that's a modest claim. Yet to preserve our favorite account of evolution by natural selection, we view our data as so bad that we never see the very process we profess to study. Wow. Let me read that part again. Yet we preserve our favorite account of evolution by natural selection. We view our data as so bad that we never see the very process we profess to study. I don't have enough faith to be an evolutionist, let me tell you. At least I have evidence of God. I can't see him, but at least there's some evidence out there of him. They can't see it and don't have any evidence. It's unbelievable. So yeah, I love that quote anyway. I gave it to those guys. I'm sure they loved it too. Here's one more from Stephen Jay Gould. Same publication. New species almost always appeared suddenly in the fossil record with no intermediate links to ancestors and older rocks of the same region. They just pop up. Yep, appeared suddenly. Almost implying some type of creation thing, I guess. The problem with the missing links are, they're all missing. Yeah, that's the problem. That's why they call them missing links. There aren't any. Yeah, they're all missing. And all the ones that they've come up with over the years have been lies, like Piltdown Man, Nebraska Man. They take an extinct pig's tooth and from it create this ape man walking all hunched over in the textbooks. A tooth! They take a tooth from an extinct pig and create this ape man. It's just lies. It's absolute deception. You give it to kids. They don't know any different. They look at the pictures. Oh, that looks good to me, right? That must be where we came from. Yeah, it's lies. Absolute lies. The evolutionists have condemned themselves. Jesus said in Luke 19 and verse 22, "Out of thine own mouth will I judge thee, thou wicked servant." Matthew 12 and verse 37 says, "For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned." And old Job said, "Thine own mouth," or God said to Job, "Thine own mouth condemneth thee, and not I. Yea, thine own lips testify against thee." I think it was one of Job's friends that said that. But anyway, "Thine own mouth condemneth thee." You've heard it. I mean, I've given you the quotes from their own publications, their own writings, saying they have zero evidence of transitional forms, which is the evidence of macroevolution. If you don't have transitional forms, you don't have evolution. There is no evolution without transitional forms. That is evolution by definition. Species transforming, transitioning into other species. If you don't have it, either today or in the fossil record, you don't have evolution. It's just not there. It's amazing. The theory of macroevolution is an unsubstantiated hypothesis at best, and it's a blind faith religion at worst. And I go for the latter. It's a religion. They have to get rid of God. They have to supplant God's religion with their own religion that gets rid of him. And they have to come up with a cute little story that shows us that there is no God. That's what it's all about. Now let's look at the linchpin of the theory of evolution. That's billions of years. If they don't have the billions of years, there is no time for evolution. Like I said last time, nobody's going to say in 6,000 years all the species we have evolved from pond scum to you. Nobody's going to say that. Nobody's that stupid. So you got to have billions of years. Evolutionary scientists now claim that the universe is, and they're very precise, 13.798 billion years, but plus or minus 0.037 billion. Plus or minus 37 million years, you know, who's counting anyway, you know? So we're not going to get precise about it, you know. We're just within 37 million years or so, plus or minus. Yeah, I'm kind of, you know, I'm making fun of them because they deserve to be made fun of. That was from Wikipedia. They also claim that the Earth is a mere 4.54 billion years, plus or minus 0.05 billion, you know, plus or minus 50 million. Who's counting, right? 50 million here, 50 million there, no big deal. That's from Wikipedia too. As they continue to realize that the fairy tale of evolution requires more and more time to appear possible, they keep adding zeros on to the supposed age of the universe. And like I said last time, you remember what Stuart Crane used to say? What's a zero? A zero is nothing. It just makes a good story better. So, you know, anytime we need more time, just add on some more zeros. No big deal. No big deal. Now, no human being can possibly conceive how long a billion years is, and that's exactly the way they want it. Throw a number out there so big that it boggles your mind and you couldn't even understand it. Good. That'll keep you nice and ignorant, and you'll believe all the nonsense we're going to tell you now. Use a bunch of fancy scientific words and numbers that numb the mind, and the unwashed masses will believe it because the worldly wise men say it is so. That's all you got to do. It's worked out very well for them. This reminds me of what the Bible says in 2 Peter 2 and verse 3. With feigned words and great swelling words of vanity, they make merchandise of people. 2 Peter 3 and verse 2. Great swelling words. Everybody admires smart people, and the more letters on the end of your name, the more they admire you. So you get a bunch of letters on the end of your name, and then you start throwing around these huge figures that nobody could even possibly conceive of, and then say a bunch of stuff happened in this large amount of time, and well, you know, the smart guys say it happened. It must have happened. 2 Peter 2 and verse 3. And through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not. And this is speaking of false prophets, not necessarily atheistic evolutionists. But still, feigned words, they make merchandise of you. And they do. They sell a lot of textbooks. You know, they make money at it. 2 Peter 2 and verse 18. For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error. Great swelling words of vanity. This is nothing new. You know, people do it now. They did it back then too. And Jude 1 and verse 16. Jude 1 and verse 16. These are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lust, and their mouth speaketh great swelling words, having men's person in admiration because of advantage. They've got all the Ivy League education. They've got all the degrees, and people admire them because of their advantage. And they speak out the great swelling words. Well, I, for one, don't really care about that kind of stuff. Doesn't mean a thing to me. Now, all of the scientific dating methods which are used to date material on Earth, like carbon-14 or radiometric dating, are based on unproven assumptions. Now, anybody that knows anything would never refer to carbon-14 dating to establish millions of years. And any dummy that says that, you can easily destroy that argument and no problem. The half-life of carbon is 5,700 years, 5,730 years. I think I got a quote about that in just a second. But the half-life of that, which means that if carbon is in a living being or in any type of material, in 5,730 years from now, there's going to be half as much carbon in it as there is now. And then in 5,730 years later, there's going to be half as much again. So there's going to be a quarter as much as there was to start with, and so on and so on. Once you get to five half-lives, there's not enough carbon left to measure. So roughly about 30,000 years, you can't date something accurately. And I don't think you can't date something accurately at 30,000 years either, since the universe isn't that old. But anyway, we'll get into that in a second, into the reasons because of that. But anyway, anybody that says carbon-14 dating, just tell them to go do some homework, because they clearly have no clue what they're talking about. Let's see. Here's another quote. I believe this was also from Dr. Brown. He says, to date an event or thing that preceded written records, one must assume that the dating clock is operated at a known rate. That's the first thing. That the clock's initial setting is known. That's the second one. And that the clock has not been disturbed. These three assumptions are almost always unstated, overlooked, or invalid. So what he's saying is, if you're going to use one of these dating methods, you have to know the rate at which it runs, and that it's always been constant. So if you're looking at the half-life of carbon, or of uranium, or thermium, I think is another one. If you're looking at these half-lives, you have to know, number one, that this is a constant half-life, that this has always behaved this way, that it's always decayed at the same rate. How would you know that? How would you know how it decayed, you know, millions of years ago? Number two, you have to know the initial amount of uranium or whatever the element is to measure how much you have left. So how do you know there was, let's say, an ounce of uranium a million years ago and it's got a half-life of a million years? I'm just totally making these numbers up. I don't know what the half-life is offhand. But if it is if the half-life's a million years and you measure a rock that has a half an ounce of uranium, you say, since I know there was an ounce a million years ago, and the half-life, since I know there was an ounce to start out with, and the half-life's a million years, and now I have a half ounce, well, that means that this rock's a million years old. How do you know there was an ounce of uranium in that rock to start out with? How do you know what the original amount is? You don't have any idea. How could you know that? So yeah, these things are suspect. Here's a quote from Wikipedia. This is how they do the radiometric dating. Rock minerals naturally contain certain elements and not others. By the process of radioactive decay of radioactive isotopes, including or occurring in a rock, exotic elements can be introduced over time. By measuring the concentration of the stable end product of the decay, coupled with knowledge of the half-life and initial concentration of the decaying element, and that underline is mine, you have to know the initial concentration of the decaying element. How in the world would you know that? If it was billions of millions or billions of years ago, the age of the rock can be calculated. Typical radioactive end products are argon from potassium-40 and lead from uranium and thorium decay. That's the Wikipedia article. So uranium and thorium decay into lead. Potassium-40 decays into argon. So they measure the amount of lead in there, and they can tell supposedly how old that rock is by how much lead is in there, or the lack of uranium. Now, how could anyone living today have any idea what the initial concentration of the element in a rock was millions or billions of years ago? Your BS detector should be sounding off right about now. How would you know that? Now, the carbon-14 rates can only be used to date things, and I already pretty much already said this, to only 30,000 years because the half-life is only 5,730 years. So if that half-life stuff doesn't make sense, I can explain it to you in greater detail later. Now, furthermore, these dating methods assume a uniformitarian perspective, which means that everything has always been like it is now with no major changes that have taken place in the planet, like a global flood. Right. So they all assume that everything has just continued on just like it is today. There have been no major cataclysmic events, get it there a third time, in Earth history. Except, of course, for giant asteroids hitting the Earth and killing off the dinosaurs. But other than that, there's been no major catastrophes on Earth. Except for the ones that need, you know, we need to have to fit our theory. But other than that, definitely not a global flood. There's no evidence for a global flood, by the way. Because if there was evidence, you know, a global flood, what would that leave? What would leave millions and millions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the face of the Earth? But we don't see any evidence for a global flood. All we see is millions and millions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the face of the Earth. We don't see any evidence for that. That is a quote from Ken Ham, by the way, not my original. But anyway, no evidence for a global flood, though, they say. Uniformitarian is, when you're speaking of geology, which is the primary definition, one who maintains or accepts the theory that geological processes and phenomena have always been and still are due to causes and forces operating continuously and with uniformity. So everything has always happened just like it is now. Things are continuing on, decaying, and everything else at the same rate that they always have. Uniformitarianism and denying the global flood is nothing new. Scoffers have been doing this for the last 2,000 years. You look there in 2 Peter and verses 3 through 6. 2 Peter 3, 3 through 6. This is nothing new. Second Peter 3:3-6. Whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment of perdition and ungodly men. Now, I wanted to start in verse 3. I don't know what I'm doing. Second Peter 3:3. I started down too far. Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Uniformitarian, right there, by definition. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water. whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. So people are willingly ignorant of the creation of the universe, and they're willingly ignorant of the flood. Now that willingly ignorant in the Greek is a Greek word that means dumb on purpose. Not really. That's one I stole from Ken Hovind. So anyway, yeah, dumb on purpose. That's what willingly ignorant means. They see no evidence for it, yet it's everywhere. Literally, all over the face of the earth. The universe is not billions of years old. The Bible plainly shows that the universe is approximately 6,000 years old, not billions. There's an unbroken genealogy in the Bible from Jesus Christ to Adam. I'm not going to read it. It would take a while. But it's in Luke 3, 23 through 38. Starts with Jesus, goes the whole way back to Adam. Unbroken, so-and-so is the son of so-and-so is the son of so-and-so, the whole way back. No room for millions or billions of years. So that takes us back to, well, not quite to the beginning, to 6 days after the beginning. And then, of course, we know, as we saw last time, the universe was created in 6 days. And I covered that extensively last time. So there you have it. You got Jesus Christ the whole way back to Adam, and then add 6 days, and you get about 6,000 years, if you actually go through the chronology of it. And you can do that. You can carefully examine the chronology, and you can pretty much get the whole way up to Daniel, and then you can get the prophecy of Daniel to the Messiah 483 years later. So you can pretty much nail it down really close to, I mean, I'm not saying down to the year, but very close. And people have done that. If you want to get a good book on that, Philip Morrow wrote a book called The Wonders of Bible Chronology. It's a great reference, and he plainly shows this, and he lists out the dates, and he writes it in layman's terms. It's a small book, maybe a couple hundred pages at the most, maybe not even that much. He did a lot of work from a man named Anstey, I think was his name. Anstey was a big-time Bible chronologer, and Morrow used a lot of his work. Anyway, so the Bible, I mean, there's no doubt, biblically, the earth is 6,000 years old. And any Christian that does not believe that, just doesn't believe the Scripture, plain and simply. At that meetup group again, you know, we were outnumbered, like, I say we, I guess I, really. I mean, it was five theists and seven atheists. But then of the theists, I was the only one that believed in creation there. Even of the Christians, you know, Catholics, Lutherans, everybody, I was the only one. And then another Christian guy was there, and he was telling me that I need, you know, I said, you know, the earth is, you know, it was created in 6 days, and it's a literal account in Genesis. It says in Exodus that in 6 days the Lord created the heaven and the earth. And he said, well, you need to read so-and-so book explains that. I said, I've read Genesis. I don't need to read your book. I don't need that. So anyway, it's very plain. If you don't believe it, well, tough. And, you know, go pound sand. I don't know what to tell you. Much scientific evidence shows that the earth and universe are young, and I'm going to give some examples of that here. These are from Walt Brown's book again, and this is from his latest version. I noticed that a couple of things that he put in the version that I have are not in the latest version, so maybe they've examined these arguments, and maybe, you know, further examination has shown that some of the things that he brought out there maybe weren't so. And that happens, you know, in science. I mean, you have a hypothesis and you prove it out, and more information, sometimes, you know, your hypothesis wasn't right. So I don't know if that's the case. I'm just assuming that if it wasn't included, it probably wasn't the best argument. So anyway, this is from the latest version of his book, which he has online, which is really nice for copying and pasting. I don't have to sit here and write out all this stuff. So that was nice. Let's look at human artifacts. So there have been human artifacts that have been found in coal and rocks that are, quote, millions of years old. You know, long before humans were around, somehow humans were creating artifacts and burying them in coal. How'd that happen? From Dr. Brown. At various times and places, man-made objects have been found encased in coal. Examples include a thimble, an iron pot, an iron instrument, an 8-carat gold chain, 3 throwing spears, and a metallic vessel inlaid with silver. Other, quote, out-of-place artifacts, unquote, have been found inside deeply buried rocks, like nails, a screw, a strange coin, a tiny ceramic doll, and other objects of obvious human manufacture. By evolutionary dating techniques, these objects would be hundreds of millions of years older than man. So maybe those little amoebas back then were creating themselves some tools to work with. I don't know. So anyway, he's got all the references, and he shows, you know, all the findings of these things and pictures of them and all that. He does have pictures in his book of all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, how did that happen? How in the world, underneath hundreds of sometimes even miles deep of earth, you have coal seams and you're finding human artifacts encased in coal. You know, how exactly did that happen? Maybe a great flood happened and everything, all the vegetation, everything got packed under beneath a bunch of mud and all those artifacts got packed in there with it and it got turned into coal. There's an idea. How about helium? There's too much helium, there's not enough helium in the atmosphere for the earth to be millions of years old. The thing that happened, well, maybe I'll just read it to you here. Does it say? I'll just read it to you rather than summarizing. He says again, Dr. Brown, that is, one product of radioactive decay within rocks is helium, a light gas. This helium enters the atmosphere at a much faster rate than helium escapes the atmosphere. Large amounts of helium should not escape into outer space, even when considering helium's low atomic weight. Radioactive decay for only uranium and thorium would produce all the atmosphere's helium in only 40,000 years. Therefore, the atmosphere appears to be young. So if just those two elements, uranium and thorium, would produce, because the byproduct, when uranium breaks down into lead, the byproduct is helium, just those two elements in 40,000 years would produce all the helium that we have in the atmosphere now. Why don't we have a whole bunch more helium over millions and millions of years of this uranium and thorium decaying? How about excess fluid pressure? There's far too much oil, gas, and water pressure in the earth for it to be millions of years old. That's why we're able to get all this oil out of the ground, all this gas. It's under pressure. And you just, especially back in the day, it's harder to get it now, but back in the day, all you had to do is just drill down into it and it just sprays up out of the ground. It was under enormous pressure. Well, how does that happen if it's millions of years old? Here's a quote. Abnormally high oil, gas, and water pressures exist within relatively permeable rock. If these fluids had been trapped for more than 10,000 to 100,000 years, leakage would have dropped these pressures far below what they are today. This oil, gas, and water must have been trapped suddenly and recently. Great flood explains all that stuff. How about continental erosion? The continents would be flat due to erosion if the earth were hundreds of millions of years old. We wouldn't have any mountains left. Here's another quote from Dr. Brown. The continents are eroding at a rate that would level them in much less than 25 million years. And the earth is billions and billions. That's many, many times 25 million years. However, evolutionists believe that fossils of animals and plants at high elevations have somehow avoided this erosion for more than 300 million years. Resilient little fossils they are. How about moon recession? The moon is too close to Earth for it to be billions of years old. Dr. Brown says again, as tidal friction gradually slows Earth's spin, the laws of physics require the moon to recede from Earth. Edmund Halley first detected this recession in 1695. Even if the moon began orbiting Earth's surface, the moon should have moved to its present distance from Earth in billions of years less time than the 4.5 billion year age evolutionists assume for the Earth and moon. So the Earth-Moon system must be much younger than evolutionists assume. So the moon is gradually moving farther and farther away from Earth. I forget what the fate. I thought I read it one time. It was like an inch, a couple inches a year or something like that. But I don't remember what I read there. But as I remember reading and seeing before, the rate at which it's moving away, the moon would have been so close to the Earth millions or billions of years ago that because the moon controls the tides, right? So the moon, you know, pulls the water away from Earth as it's going around it. And it controls the tides. Well, the moon would have been so close to Earth, it would have flooded the Earth twice a day. The only problem is you can only drown once a day. So after the first time, I don't know where life exactly would be. Maybe marine life, I don't know. But anyway, so don't quote me on that. That's what I remember seeing in a Kent Ham video, or in a Kent Hovind video a long time ago. So anyway, how about hot planets? We got some planets out there that are just too hot to be as old as evolutionists say they are. The planets of Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune are too hot to be billions of years old. Here's another quote from Dr. Brown. He says, Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune each radiate away more than twice the heat energy they receive from the sun. Uranus and Venus also radiate too much heat. Calculations show that it is very unlikely that this energy comes from nuclear fusion, radioactive decay, gravitational contraction, or phase changes within those planets. This suggests that these planets have not existed long enough to cool off. So I don't know how they measure all this stuff on planets so far away, but that's what they say anyway. So I don't know. And lastly, supernova remnants. There are only about 7,000 years worth of supernova debris found in our galaxy. Now, this is according to Dr. Brown. He says, in galaxies similar to our Milky Way galaxy, a star will explode every 26 years or so. These explosions, called supernovas, produce gas and dust that expand outward thousands of miles per second. With radio telescopes, these remnants in our galaxy should be visible for a million years. However, only about 7,000 years worth of supernova debris are seen. So the Milky Way looks young. I wonder why it would only be 7,000 years. Maybe it happens to be because the universe is only 6,000 years old, and that's pretty close to 7. So anyway, that's all I have for you today. I hope you suffered with me as you didn't get a lot of Bible. So go home this afternoon and read yourself a chapter so you don't feel like you've been starved to death. But I hope this was beneficial for you anyway. And next time we will look at some more things. Next time I'll have more Bible for you. We're going to talk about the Great Flood and the hydroplate theory and all that kind of fun stuff. So I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.